Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up today, the Archbishop of Westminster, Vincent Nichols, comments on the so-called Pope Francis effect. A report on Pope Francis's weekly general audience. When Pope Paul VI instituted the World Day of Prayer for Vocations. A timely reflection to mark the Pope's feast day, which falls on April 23rd. A very personal look at the Second Vatican Council document, which focused on Catholic education. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. It's been just over a month now since the election of Pope Francis as 265th successor of Peter. And we often hear of the so-called Francis effect. Philippa Hitchin asked the Archbishop of Westminster, Vincent Nichols, what that might be.
Well, I think what is most remarkable in the United Kingdom is that everybody seems to have been touched by the eloquence and the gentleness and, if you like, the humility of Pope Francis. So I sat next to a couple on the aeroplane coming over here, and they talked about a fresh start for the Catholic Church with this new Pope Francis. And at the end of the conversation, I said to them, "Are you Catholics?" And they said, "Oh, no, we're not Catholics, but we can see very clearly what's going on, and he touches our life too." And I think that's true of many, many people in the United Kingdom. I think it builds on the impact of the visit of Pope Benedict to the United Kingdom in 2010. But Pope Francis, without a doubt, in his eloquence, his humility, in the way he talks about the need for God's mercy, in his care for the poorest, the weakest, the marginalized, has really touched the majority of people at home, not simply the Catholic community.
Now, why don't we focus on Pope Francis's catechesis at his weekly general audience? Emma McCarthy reports.
The ascension of Jesus into heaven does not mean his absence, but that he is alive among us in a new way, close to each one of us. But to enter into the glory of God demands daily fidelity to his will, even when it requires sacrifice. This was Pope Francis's own tweeted summary of his lessons on the Creed this Wednesday, which explored the phrase, "He ascended into heaven and is seated at the right hand of the Father."
Cari fratelli e sorelle, buongiorno.
Translating the Holy Father's words into English was Monsignor Philip Whitmore.
In our catechesis on the Creed during this year of faith, we now consider the article which deals with Christ's ascension. He ascended into heaven and is seated at the right hand of the Father. St. Luke invites us to contemplate the mystery of the ascension in the light of the Lord's entire life, and particularly his decision to ascend to Jerusalem to embrace his saving passion and death in obedience to the Father's will. Two aspects of Luke's account are significant. First, before returning to the glory of the Father, the risen Jesus blesses his disciples. Jesus thus appears as our eternal priest. True God and true man, he now forever makes intercession for us before the Father. Second, Luke tells us that the apostles returned to Jerusalem with great joy. They realize that the risen Lord, though no longer physically present, will always be with them, guiding the life of the church until he returns in glory. As we contemplate the mystery of the ascension, may we too bear joyful witness to the Lord's resurrection, his loving presence in our midst, and the triumph of his kingdom of life, holiness, and love.
Carissimi fratelli e sorelle, abbiamo questo avvocato. Non abbiamo paura di andare da lui.
Noting that St. John writes in his first letter that Jesus is our advocate with the Father, in unscripted comments, Pope Francis noted that Christ defends us from the pitfalls of the devil, from ourselves and from our sins, and he appealed to people not to be afraid to turn to Jesus with our fears, to ask for his blessing and mercy, because as our constant advocate in heaven, he always forgives us and defends us. And as has become tradition, Pope Francis concluded the audience with a tour of the square among the pilgrims in his open-top jeep, a tour that lasted over an hour, during which the Holy Father blessed infants and newlyweds and embraced the ill and suffering present in the square, and during which he also received a gift of a brand new papal zucchetto from a pilgrim, which he immediately put on to the crowd's delight. I'm Emma McCarthy.
And now while our thanks there go to Emma McCarthy, why don't we look ahead to the fourth Sunday in Easter, when Pope Francis is scheduled to celebrate Holy Mass in St. Peter's Basilica, a Mass during which there will be ordinations to the priesthood. It's a celebration which takes place during this year of faith, and it marks the 50th World Day of Prayer for Vocations, and has a theme, Vocations as a Sign of Hope Founded in Faith. This celebration was first instituted by Pope Paul VI at the time of the Second Vatican Council, as you may hear from this radio message dated 11th of April 1964. In a few moments, I'll be bringing you that archive recording in Italian, first broadcast through the microphones of Vatican Radio, as well as a translation in English read for us by Sean Patrick Lovett.
Il problema del numero sufficiente dei sacerdoti tocca da vicino tutti I fedeli.
The problem of having a sufficient number of priests has an immediate impact on all of the faithful, not simply because they depend on it for the religious future of Christian society,
perché ne dipende l'avvenire religioso della società cristiana,
but also because this problem is the precise and inescapable indicator of the vitality of faith and love of individual, parish, and diocesan communities, and the evidence of the moral health of Christian families. Wherever numerous vocations to the priesthood and consecrated life are to be found, that is where people are living the gospel with generosity.
Ove numerose sbocciano le vocazioni allo stato ecclesiastico e religioso, là si vive generosamente secondo il Vangelo.
This excerpt from the radio message of Paul VI was quoted by Benedict XVI, now Pope Emeritus, in his message for this 21st of April, first released when he was still Pope, obviously, in October 2012, in which he also urged young people not to be afraid to follow Christ and walk the demanding and courageous paths of charity and generous commitment. In that way, he insisted, they will be happy to serve, be witnesses to a joy that the world cannot give, be living flames of an infinite and eternal love, and will learn to give an account of the hope that is within them. Meanwhile, on a different note, looking ahead to next week here in the Vatican, we're marking St. George's Day in a special way. Yes, Cardinal Bergoglio may have taken the name Francis as Pope, but his Christian name is Jorge, George, to you and me. That's why I've chosen to bring you a timely reflection for the 23rd of April. That's with Monsignor Peter Fleetwood.
During my years teaching at the seminary in the northeast of England, I became quite experienced at finding my way across the Pennines, the mountains that divide the country into east and west. One thing that can shock you if you're driving across the mountains at night is a set of pairs of bright green lights that suddenly appear out of nowhere. They are the eyes of sheep that are allowed to wander on the open road. Part of the art of driving across the mountains is to be on the lookout for sheep. If you meet sheep frequently, you have to laugh when Jesus talks about his sheep, because he's talking about us. Bishops must laugh when they hear themselves described as pastors or shepherds, because their job is to herd the sheep into the fold, to give them nourishment and protection. It is a beautiful image, but a humorous one, especially if what you see on the mountaintops are sheep being herded by a dog. Sometimes it is tempting to reject the comparison between ourselves and sheep, because sheep look so mindless. Why bother if all we are is a crowd of gullible creatures being fattened for the slaughter? But if you listen to the words of John's Gospel, you can actually be quite touched by the image, because Jesus is talking about sheep that recognize his voice and trust him. He gives them eternal life so they will never perish. No one will snatch them away from him. He's proud of his sheep because he got them from his Father, and nobody can steal from the Father because he is greater than anyone. That sounds like quite a nice image after all. It is all about knowing the Lord well enough to recognize him and trust him. It is a promise that we shall never be abandoned. I don't mind being encouraged to be like that, do you? In England, our patron saint is Saint George. He is always depicted with another kind of animal. The legends vary, but he is always shown as a soldier fighting a dragon to save someone else's life. He was demoted when they sorted out the list of saints many years ago, but he is still there on the calendar, and those who remember still wear a red rose on St. George's Day in England. We sorely need a patron in heaven, so I have no problem with that. These feasts of national patron saints do make us pray for our countries, which is no bad thing. The saints are there as models for us to imitate, but where would we find dragons to fight these days? Children at high schools will say there is no such thing as a dragon, and the ones who watch wildlife programs will say that the only things even vaguely resembling dragons are Komodo lizards thousands of miles away from England. So what has St. George killing a dragon got to do with Catholics in England? Of course, they are right. The dragon really is a mythical animal. But myths contain symbols, and symbols sum up some aspect of life that is very important or powerful. I suspect the dragon represents evil in any form. Some people may not like to hear this, but the dragon may represent evil people, which fits with the way we use the word when speaking of unbearable old women. That will be branded as politically incorrect, but I would certainly never suggest there is any difference between the depths of evil men and women reach. The dragon is a symbol of the power evil people can wield in this world. They can force good people into submission and either damage them, or humiliate them, or lead them astray. This is a frightening reality, and it is a reminder that sometimes goodness and holiness mean bravery in the face of wickedness. At a baptism, the new Christian is exorcised, not because she or he is possessed, but because the Christian Church recognizes where human power runs out, and we simply have to rely on God. St. George is a reminder that we need help to survive when evil is about. It may be a naive symbolism, but the pictures and statues of St. George are all about the battle between good and evil. They also hark back to what Jesus said about his sheep. He was there to protect them because they needed protection. St. George is a reminder that sometimes good people are called upon to bother, to be brave, and offer that protection in place of Jesus.
And you were listening there to Monsignor Peter Fleetwood in one of his reflections for the series Why Bother? Staying Catholic Despite It All. What I'd like to do now is join a popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster. On October 28, 1965, Pope Paul VI issued a Declaration of Catholic Education by the title of Gravissimum Educationis. Father Reginald Foster believes it is a shame this council document has so far largely been ignored. I thought I'd bring you the first part of this interview, in which I also quiz Father Foster as to how the ancient Romans viewed education. Stay tuned. We're going to speak about education today, Father. The Declaration on Christian Education from Vatican II.
Gravissimum Educationis, October of 65.
Was it a groundbreaking document, or was it just one of the less important
ones? I don't
ones?
Know whether it was groundbreaking, but as I go through it, I can't believe the glorious content that's there and the brilliance that's there. And, of course, the Latin expression is superb, absolutely superb. And I was thinking, I'd like to know, in the past 50 years, how often this document has been quoted from Vatican II. I bet 5 times in 50 years. It's a glorious, glorious thing. There are sections which are talking about education alone, and then Christian Catholic education. But even if you're not interested in Christian Catholic education, even the paragraphs and the sentences about the nature and the essence and the demands and the foundations of human education are absolutely spectacular. And you never hear anyone talking in these terms. I hate to say it.
In the first chapter, I picked this paragraph where it's written that all men...
You picked it out.
I did. You don't like it?
What? I don't know. What paragraph is that?
Omnibus hominibus cuius vis stirpis. All men of every race, condition and age, since they enjoy the dignity of a human being, have an inalienable right to an education. It's the first paragraph. Do you like that paragraph?
Let me see. I can't find it. Ah! Oh, yeah, I see. You're starting with number one, because there's a whole introduction there. And the second paragraph there is about 17 lines about young people and children, and it's just out of this world. And have you read through that? Well, I don't care. Take the first thing. It's to all people of every kind of race and condition and age, inasmuch as rejoicing in the dignity of a person, there is an inalienable right to education.
Conditionis et etatis ut pote dignitate personae, polentibus.
You have to go to polentibus, because polentibus goes with hominibus. All human beings rejoicing or being strong, dignitate personae, with the dignity of a human person.
In Latin it reads, ius est inalienabile et educationem.
Yes, yes. There is a right, an inalienable right to education, and then it goes on, respondentem, corresponding to their proper or its proper end and their proper character and the difference of sex,
culture
accommodated, accommodatam, to the traditions of culture and of the ancestors. And he says, and at the same time...
At the same time is et simul, no?
Simul. Yes, yes. And at the same time, and you see, it's apertam in the next line, is going with educationem in the third line up above. This education open at the same time, fraterne consortioni, to fraternal connection or fraternal living, cum alias populis, with other peoples. It is open for true unity and for promoting true unity and peace on earth. Why, this is a whole symphony of stuff here.
Covendam is fostering, right?
Yes, exactly. By the way, I would point out, as far as the Latin goes, this is one Latin sentence. And it's gloriously written.
Isn't it too long?
But you better know what you're doing.
Isn't it too long a sentence?
No, it's not too long, is it? In those days, it wasn't long a sentence. It was kind of stupid. Nowadays, yeah, they would think this came from heaven. But it isn't. It's just very well written, very nicely written.
Who among your friends, the Romans, might have written a document like this?
Oh, they wouldn't have. No, they wouldn't have written it. No, no. The Romans wouldn't have written this way, inasmuch as this is what should I say, much more evolved sociologically and psychologically. They wouldn't have talked about education corresponding to one's own nature and the difference of sex and culture. The Romans, now, they didn't have those categories in their heads. They probably would have said of age and maybe social condition, but this is much more, I would say, modern or stuffed with our own kind of concepts and ideas of today. And these really escaped the Romans kind of totally. They would have said, you know, free people and slaves and children and parents and the state and citizenry, that would have been about the end of it. But this goes infinitely further, of course. Or, for example, they're to promote true unity and peace on earth. Well, the Romans, they never thought in those terms. The Romans wouldn't have had this idea, education for promoting true unity and peace on earth, because for the Romans, it was the Senate and the Roman army which was going to promote true peace and unity on earth. So these ideas are our ideas. And that's the problem with some of these documents in Latin, because the Romans just didn't talk this way.
The army was very present in the Roman times. I read that 4th century Vegetius thought that recruits in the army were not even savvy enough to keep the books of their corps, of their army corps.
No. Of course not. But it was a totally different idea of what they were doing in the world. And in the old days, of course, it was, everyone knows that, it was a privilege to be a soldier, and you had to bring your own stuff, your own equipment, and your own provisions, and your own food and everything else. It was a privilege to be a soldier. And so it was a completely different idea. So when they come around and say that education is supposed to promote or foster unity and peace, well, that's an idea which I'm afraid just never entered the mind of the Romans. That's all. Well, that's so what? So here we have a couple thousand years in between.
But Gravissimum Educazione speaks of family. Now, the Romans were very attentive to families, weren't they?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It was a hierarchy there, and that the father was in charge of everything, and the women had their place, and children were to obey their parents as long as their parents were alive. Again, the concepts are completely different, and that's one of the problems that people have, that we had, even with papal documents. It's not, you know, what is an atomic hairpin or a flight to the moon. That's easy to say in Latin. But to express some of these concepts, which the Romans simply did not have, that was just like that the family would be the nucleus. Certainly the family was there, but they understood it in a different way without sociology and all our other fine things that we've thought up in the meanwhile.
In this document, when they speak about the duties and rights of parents, they talk about children and how parents should enjoy true liberty in their choice of schools. Well, did the Romans have schools?
Well, let's put it this way. One of my favorite authors, Quintilian, was the first public school teacher, but he was installed by Vespasian. But look at where we are, away after Christ there, 68, there we are, to 78 A.D. So what the Romans had were private tutors. That was the big thing. The Romans would get, especially Greeks, they would get Greek, who were slaves, and they lived in the house, and it was all home education. It really was.
It was a sort of tutor, guardian, and servant of the child, no? And he was known as the pedagogus, no?
The pedagogus. Why? Because he would abide all pies. Again, he would lead the child like he was the babysitter of the child and would take the child around the city. But it was a very closed, like a closed atmosphere. And schooling was done at home. And it was tutors. You had just tutors. That's all. And Cicero speaks about a famous one of his slaves who was tutoring his son and his nephew. It was later, as I say, Vespasian, in the 70s after Christ, that the first public school was established by a wonderful, really, a good emperor, Vespasian. Okay, he half-destroyed Palestine, but anyway. But he established the first public school, and our favorite, one of our favorite authors, who's a saint and a great man, and will be canonized, I hope, by the church someday, Quintilianus, and he was the first public school teacher on public pay. The government paid him. So the Romans didn't have schools. This is Romans for about 300 or 400 years. They didn't have schools as we understand schools of children sitting in little desks and so forth. They just didn't have that. It was private tutoring. And then the public schools began, especially schools of rhetoric, where they would prepare people to speak and be lawyers, technicians, and so forth and so on. So that took a lot of development also. So the Romans didn't understand schools as we have today, even in this document here.
But
that was a different thing.
There were schools of Latin eloquence, no?
Oh, yeah. Well, they didn't understand that. Yeah, I agree. Oh, yeah. Declamations, declamationes, where they used to argue cases in Greek and in Latin. That was all of your training, all part of your training and everything else. And when you were about 22 years old or so forth, after you were trained with some orator or a rhetorician in Rome, then you appeared as a lawyer and were passed, like, okay, and then you started your career as a lawyer in the courtroom and in the Senate and so forth and so on. That was your degree. It was a different system, and it just took a long time to develop this thing into what we understand as public or even private education today. But this document here that we have in front of us, I think is absolutely heavenly. It's not being quoted, and it's not being recognized at all.
Which is your favorite passage in it?
I marked one here, which actually turns out to be the next one. The next, you know, right below number one, the second paragraph begins with pueri.
Pueri igitur et adolescentes.
Yes, this is as modern. That's more modern than we are today. Children, therefore, and young people, consideration having been had for the progress of psychological, pedagogical, and didactical knowledge must be helped in order to develop their physical, moral, and intellectual endowments in a harmonious way. For heaven's sakes, it sounds like it was written yesterday.
And our thanks there go to Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, who was for many years and under many popes papal Latinist, including under Benedict XVI, and is currently teaching Latin in the United States. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget, we'll be back again at this same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then. You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.